And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, this Tuesday rather, March 21st, 2023. The U.S. government is calling on the transitional government of South Sudan to protect humanitarian workers across the country.
We join international partners in condemning the March 17th attack on a World Food Program convoy in Jungli State, in which two people were killed and several others injured.
And leaders from Eastern Sudan oppose any deal to hand over power to civilians in Sudan.
What is going on at the moment is a great betrayal to the Sudanese martyrs, including the victims of the December Revolution.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Embassy in Juba is condemning last week's attack on a World Food Program convoy in Jungle Estate, which resulted in the killing of two people and several others injured. The U.S. has called on leaders of the transitional government of South Sudan and its security forces to prevent attacks on humanitarian workers across the country. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
We join international partners in condemning the March 17th attack on a World Food Program convoy in Jungli State, in which two people were killed and several others injured. We offer our condolences to the families of the victims.
U.S. Embassy Public Affairs Officer Molik D. Berkana reads a statement released yesterday after a humanitarian convoy of more than 100 trucks transporting food and other humanitarian assistance came under attack on Friday in Jonglei State. Two contracted drivers were shot. One died. Another person was killed in a traffic accident as a direct result of the attack. A humanitarian staffer was also injured and is receiving treatment. Berkana said the U.S. government called on South Sudan to protect all humanitarian aid workers.
We call on the leaders of the transitional government of South Sudan and its security forces to prevent attacks on humanitarian aid workers and staff.
The UN World Food Program country director in South Sudan, Alan McGrogty, said the humanitarian community is appalled by continued attacks targeting humanitarians and the assets in South Sudan, which disrupts the delivery of life-saving assistance. McGrogty says the WFP is forced to suspend its aid convoy movements outside the Jonglei State capital, Bor, after the deadly attack. Gordon Kong Bar, the Jonglei State Cabinet Affairs Minister and Acting Governor, says state officials were shocked by the attack. The minister says he is working with security forces to track down the assailants and bring them to justice.
The humanitarian agencies, together with their assets, must be protected by the state government and the government of South Sudan. This in line with the directives from His Excellency the President of the Republic, Salva Kiir Mayardit, that all the humanitarians must be protected. As the government of Jungle State, under His Excellency Dinay Jokchago, the governor of Jungle State, we are working hard now, collecting information, and we are deploying security personnel to give the maximum protection to the UN agencies, to the World Food, to other humanitarian agencies.
The WFP said the Jonglei corridor, where the movements of the aid convoy have been suspended, is critical for WFP food prepositioning ahead of the rainy season, when roads are inaccessible and more than a million people in Jonglei and Pibor rely on humanitarian food assistance. Bar says he's working with local and state authorities to ensure the safe delivery of humanitarian assistance to the most needy.
World Food, they are supporting our people. What they are doing it for us. There's no way that we can just allow them be victimized on the roads. In collaboration with our commissioners, with all the Fayams, the Bumas authorities, we must remain vigilant, protecting the humanitarian agencies. Whoever involved into this act must face the law. If the culprits are found, they will be held accountable.
In January alone, more than 20 violent incidents were carried out against humanitarian staff and assets. That is more than double the number in January 2022, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. UN OCHA says while humanitarians continue to provide much-needed support across parts of the country, repeated violent attacks hampers their efforts. So far this year, an estimated 9.4 million people in South Sudan are projected to humanitarian assistance or protection services, said OCHA. It says the humanitarian situation has worsened by endemic violence, access constraints, operational interference, public health challenges, and climate shocks such as flooding and localized drought. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
Some South Sudanese living in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, say they are concerned about the ongoing protest led by opposition leader Raila Odinga. The South Sudanese say as foreigners living in Nairobi, they don't get involved in local politics, but are still worried because the protest disrupt normal life. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Last weekend, Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga called for weekly protest over the country's cost of living crisis. On Monday during protests, clashes erupted between police and Odinga supporters. It is the first major instability in Kenya 6 months after President William Ruto took office following a narrow election victory over Odinga. Rose Banja, a Juba resident and a mother of four children studying in Nairobi, Kenya, says she worries about the safety of her children given that she is far from them during the protests. Banja says it is hard to know what is going on in Nairobi from Juba.
Some incidents happen like this, and we as parents are very far. It's always very difficult, like, to know exactly what is happening. Like, for me now, I'm just hearing that the situation is bad.
Kyobil Nundeng, a South Sudanese living in Nairobi, reached out by this program on WhatsApp, says the protests are a cause of concern for all foreigners living in Nairobi. He says everyone was affected in the Kenyan's capital, including businesses that were closed.
Many South Sudanese as foreigners have chosen to live indoors, of course. The issue is absolutely a national issue. It has nothing to do with South Sudanese or any other foreigners. So we live like other foreigners by only watching, by not involving ourselves in local politics.
Deng praises Kenya's government for being acting with restraint and respecting the rule of law. He urges South Sudanese in Juba who have relatives in Nairobi not to worry, saying the situation is back to normal.
Major demonstration was taking place yesterday. You could see police was acting responsibly. The government works within the perimeter of the law. It doesn't go past the law. The government, I think, has also respected the constitution of Kenya that allows the freedom of demonstration, which is lacking elsewhere in East Africa.
Akol Mayen, another South Sudanese residing in Nairobi, says it appears there was no much trouble resulting from yesterday's protests.
There were no distractions. Everything was, to some extent, peaceful. Kenyans are law-abiding people, so they are very much concerned about the country, and we're very careful not to destroy their properties. And the good thing, everything went back to normal today.
Media reports said bastions of Odinga supporters were burning tires while police used water cannon and tear gas to disperse protesters in Nairobi's biggest slum, Kabira. Reporters said one student was killed in Kenya on Monday in a clash between security forces and anti-government protesters. Odinga, leader of the Azimio la Moja coalition, described Monday's protest as a day of destiny. He continues to claim that Ruto's election was fraudulent and denounced his government as illegitimate. Official election results reported Odinga lost by about 233,000 votes. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba. Yeah.
Some South Sudanese women in Juba are complaining that the high cost of living in the country has put a burden on them to take care of their children. One resident of Juba says most men have abandoned homes, leaving women to care for children. The Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare says the government is working to set up the Women Enterprise Fund, stipulated in the 2018 peace agreement, to empower South Sudanese women. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Under Juba's baking sun, some South Sudanese women are trying to make ends meet by selling vegetables so they can buy maize flour to feed their children at day's end. The main topic of conversation, South Sudan's soaring prices. Jacqueline Kumsiano says the high cost of living has caused women in particular to suffer.
Women are suffering a lot. Men have run away in some families. Only women are the ones carrying the burden to feed the family. Only that a survivor in the families is not checked from family to family. There are some women who are bearing a lot more than my situation.
Another Juba resident, Rose Kerry, a mother of three, sells okra on a small table in the market in hopes of buying food for her family. Kerry says she spends most of the day trying to find a little money to feed her children.
I wake up early in the morning at 5 a.m. to come here only to return home at 6 p.m. in the evening with a lot of body pain. I swallow some painkillers in order to find sleep. What we are doing here is just to make sure our children have something to eat.
Kerry says the government has forgotten its civil population amidst rising food prices. She says the government has turned a deaf ear to the outcry of South Sudanese.
Even if you talk, there is no implementation. I want them to come to ask about the prices in the market. Does the government really monitor what is happening in the market and how people feel? They don't monitor the market. They are all happy. Their children are happy. Their children are studying. Their children are eating well, and they are not thinking about the people. They only thinking about themselves.
South Sudan Minister for Gender, Child and Social Welfare, Aya Benjamin Warile, acknowledges the suffering of women, saying the effects of COVID-19, coupled with climate change, have made the situation even worse for mothers. Warile says the good news is the Ministry of Gender is implementing some livelihood projects with international partners to help women.
We work with partners on different projects, livelihood projects, where women are supported with some capital and also training, helping them connect to markets. As we do that, we have also a bigger picture. We are looking ahead to make sure that economic empowerment of women is implemented as agreed in the R-Access.
The 2018 peace agreement calls for the establishment of the Women Enterprise Fund aimed at empowering South Sudanese women economically. Warile says her ministry is working hard and drafting a bill to present before the Council of Ministers, which will then be presented in the Transitional National Legislative Assembly to ensure that funding for women is included in next year's fiscal budget. The gender minister also says the World Bank and the African Development Bank have women economic empowerment programs for South Sudanese women that have yet to be implemented. Aya encourages women to network and share any opportunity that comes their way.
Keep networking, because that's how you get to information. Don't keep to yourself. So keep networking with others. When the time comes, you'll get to know that these resources are available, so that you can also access it. It's going to be open. It doesn't matter your level of education. So long as you're doing something, we'll get support.
As they wait for those programs to materialize, Kerry and Kumsiano are calling on the government to control the rising exchange rate of the dollar. This week, the dollar is exchanging for 870 South Sudanese pounds in the black market, compared to 830 SSP 2 weeks ago. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, some Sudanese leaders in the eastern part of the country oppose any deal that allows civilians to take control of the country. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how influential do you think foreign officials are when it comes to the way your government is run?
Well, I think they do play a big role in whatever decisions are made, because most of the time we do things to please them more than we should be doing things to benefit ourselves.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at apartheid, all of the sanctions and whatnot definitely put pressure on the government to change what it was doing. So I'd say from that perspective, they've got the influence over us.
I think they play a greater role in influencing the economy with the ties and the opportunities that they tend to bring. And yeah, some bring foreign aids and what. I think there's a positivity to it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we can all help fight the corona pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and nose when we are in crowded places or areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Some Sudanese opposition parties have rejected any political deal between the military and civilian leaders. The leader of the Berger community in eastern Sudan says the political process has done very little to address compensation for victims who suffered violations after the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese civilian leaders and military rulers have agreed to sign a final political document paving the way for the transfer of power to civilians. Both parties also resolved to form a task force committee to draft a final agreement and get it ready before the end of this month. In a press briefing shortly after the two sides met, a spokesperson for the ongoing political process, Khalid Omar Youssef, told reporters the stakeholders at the meeting approved the formation of an 11-member committee to draft the final agreement. Youssef says the final agreement is expected to be signed on April 1st and a new civilian government will be formed on April 11th. The announcement sparked anger among non-signatories to the political deal, who say they will not accept unilateral agreement between the military and only a few civilian groups. Speaking to reporters last evening in Khartoum, Muhammad Al-Amin Turik, who heads the Berger Community Council and runs political affairs for the Eastern Bloc, says the draft political agreement is not inclusive because most Sudanese people, including families of victims of all forms of violations committed in Sudan, are not included in the ongoing process. Turik calls the political agreement a betrayal of the great sacrifice made by the revolutionaries.
What is going on at the moment is a great betrayal to the Sudanese martyrs, including the victims of the December Revolution. The Sudanese people decided to claim their rights by themselves, but what is going on right now is something planned against them.
Turik vows to oppose any deal reached between the military and other civilian groups. He says, despite the strong opposition voiced by several civilian leaders of the ongoing political process, opposition groups appreciate efforts of international and regional actors in settling the situation in Sudan.
First of all, we are not here because we are against the international or regional community, and we cannot stand against the democratic transition. Instead, we would like to see our country experience stability and let our people overcome this dangerous juncture and overcome the current political and economic crisis.
Speaking last night during a debate on Al-Hadas TV channel, Muhammad Zakaria, a spokesperson of the opposition group Democratic Bloc, also rejected any move aimed at reaching a political deal which is not inclusive.
The signatories to the framework agreement did not listen or respond to our repeated appeals, and our firm called for a new dialogue. Instead, they moved forward to design a new and isolated political process of their own.
Khalid Omar Youssef, a spokesperson for the ongoing political process, said earlier that a committee was tasked to keep in touch with non-signatory groups in the hope that they would join the process before the final agreement is reached. He says the door remains open.
We sincerely wish to have these groups as part of the ongoing process in the final agreement. That is why this committee is tasked with engaging them so that they can join the process before the final draft.
The Justice and Equality Movement under the Minister of Finance, Jibril Ibrahim, the Sudan Liberation Movement led by the Regional Governor of Darfur, Mini Arko Minnawi, and the Democratic Unionist Party led by Ahmed Osman Al-Merghani, among others, have rejected the draft political agreement. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum.
From the Sudanese capital Khartoum, we move to Ethiopia, where the government there has rejected a determination by the U.S. State Department that its army, along with all sides in the recently concluded conflict in the northern Tigray region, had committed war crimes. Hussein Kiflu, a political and social commentator, tells my colleague Douglas Mpuga that the Ethiopian government should accept responsibility and try to restore its strategic relationship with the United States.
When it comes to the State Department's statement about war crimes and crimes against humanity, I mean, it's timely and it's accurate, except lacking one element, because I believe when you see the definition of genocide, the Abiy Ahmed's regime, in conjunction with his partner in crime, Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea, they have committed a genocide in Tigray. So apart from that element missing in the State Department's Antony Blinken's statement, everything that has been said about war crime and crimes against humanity is accurate. The response, like I said, from Abiy Ahmed's regime, it's typical.
But the Ethiopian government points out that such apportioning of blame is unwarranted and undercuts support of the U.S. for an inclusive peace process in Ethiopia. That, how does that one factor in?
The way they say that apportioning blame and it's one-sided, the State Department has also leveled accusation against TPLF. It's not only against the Eritrean regime and the Ethiopian regime that they have leveled this accusation. They have also blamed TPLF. So it's unacceptable what the regime in Addis Ababa is saying, once again, a refusal to accept responsibility, and now accountability is glaring them in the face. How they would bring them to the book, that's what I'm curious to see.
Yeah. In the same statement by the Ethiopian government, they say that despite all this, Ethiopia hoped its strategic relationship with the U.S. Would be restored, which is, of course, also the intention of the U.S. government. Now, despite this back and forth, how do you see this affecting the relationship?
I think that is the reason that the State Department avoided accusing the Abiy Ahmed's regime of genocide. They want to, in fact, when Antony Blinken went to Addis Ababa, Abiy Ahmed's regime, in a matter of protocol, they rebuffed him, you know, that he was supposed to be received, according to protocol, by the foreign minister of Ethiopia. but they sent some junior officer to receive him at the airport. And it tells you that on one hand, they want to have this good relationship with the United States because they are really in need of foreign currency. The economy is in shambles. So they need the United States to back them up financially. Russia cannot do that. China is certainly reluctant to do that. So on the one hand, they want to have this relationship with the United States. On the other hand, the Abiy Ahmed's regime is so immature that the United States government has a lot of accountability. The government has to answer to the public whenever it helps foreign regimes like Abiy Ahmed. So they do things, you know, with some degree of responsibility. They cannot just bail out any government with which they want to have strategic relationship. So I think the United States government, the State Department, balanced that. As you know, in the Horn of Africa, it's a very, very volatile region. So the way I see it, Washington doesn't want to lose allies from the Horn of Africa. They want to deal with these things very, very carefully. But Abiy Ahmed's regime is not giving them that chance.
That's Hussein Kiflu, a political and social commentator. He was speaking with my colleague Douglas Mpugwa from Dallas, Texas. Still on Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government has rejected a U.S. conclusion that all sides in its two-year Tigray war committed war crimes, calling it inflammatory. Mayor Miskir reports from Addis Ababa.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Monday on Twitter that the Ethiopian and Eritrean armies, Amhara region forces, and Tigray People's Liberation Front forces all committed atrocity crimes during the Tigray War that ended in November. Blinken said he condemns these atrocities and welcomes commitments to pursue transitional justice. Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs struck back in a statement Tuesday, saying it rejects the U.S. allegation that all sides committed war crimes during the Tigray conflict. It said Blinken's statement, coming a week after the Secretary of State visited Ethiopia, unfairly proportions blame and is inflammatory and untimely. The government said it has just launched national consultations on a transitional justice policy. The ministry added that a report on human rights released by the U.S. State Department on Monday does not contain any information that wasn't included in a previous joint report done by the UN and Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission. In a separate report released by the UN last September, investigators had found evidence of crimes against humanity by the Ethiopian government, including using starvation as a weapon. The government rejected that report. Maya Msikir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
And that's all we prepared for you on this Tuesday, which is Mother's Day in North Africa. We now leave you with the song Mama by Mawa.
Yeah. This song is a special dedication to all the mothers out there as a sign of appreciation, as a sign of love. Mawa, Mwana Minga. Shanita biligo, iya haja itader, shalakan haja al, anama biyag der, ashanita taban waratai, minana suker, itageni hanisana kanana gikore, katiana mimotoro, kaman sekete.
We have been listening to Mawa and the song Mama. I'm your host John Tanza in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer Nabil Biagio and Gwen Oten and engineer Nashwan Kali, we wish you a good evening and thanks for taking time to be with us. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama.